Here on the Eastern Oklahoma Catholic Podcast, you can find all things Catholic in the Diocese of Tulsa and Eastern Oklahoma.
I was reading that 90% of podcasts quit after three episodes. Okay. And so another 90% after that quit after episode 20. So we can sincerely say it feels good to be in the top 1% of all podcasts ever created. And so that's something that a little math there to figure that one out. Welcome to Tulsa Time with Bishop Condorla. My name's Derek Lissy, and I am your host. Bishop David, how are you doing this week?
I'm good. You're back from the West, huh? You were out in Phoenix?
That's right. I was out in Phoenix for the Theology of the Gift Conference, really a fundraising conference for Catholic fundraisers or Catholic development professionals, and was invited out there by a mutual friend of ours, Peter DeCaratry. To speak on transformational giving and major gifts. So it was a great conference. Monsignor James Shea from UMary opened us up, and it was really put on by them. I was fascinated by the fact that the Arizona State Catholic Studies program is run by the University of Marietta, North Dakota, and they partnered up years ago, and kind of a unique partnership between a public state university and a small Catholic university, right. A partnership you wouldn't typically see. And so a unique opportunity to go out there. And so it was a great conference.
But I like the term you just used, transformational giving. And so I think probably most people think of a development director, your job, as a person who goes around and asks for money.
Yeah.
And maybe the actual better way to understand it is a person who facilitates this kind of transformational giving. And so the difference between them in my mind is that not just the wealthy, everyone have an obligation to be good stewards, to recognize that what we have comes as a blessing to us from God, and God expects us to be good stewards with what we have by sharing it with other people as well. Some people have wealth that is large enough that they can make a gift that can be transformational for some ministry, meaning it could be sort of, let's say, St. John's in Stillwater, our new Catholic center that we've built out there, that was basically established on two main gifts. So we could certainly say those are transformational gifts. Anyone who looks at that new center and sees all the impact it can make now can understand that it is transforming the ministry, that facility. But also, everyone can make a transformational gift because it also is transformational in their own life.
Yep.
So even if for me, $100 is like, holy mackerel, giving $100 to this this apostolate that I'm very passionate about represents a lot of money for me. Well, if I feel strongly about something they're doing and I give that $100, trusting that God will help me, that's transformational for me. So
I always think of it as there's three different transformations that need to happen. So there's oftentimes we think of the challenge of the transformation for just the giver, the person who can make a financial contribution at a simple level. That's maybe the way we think of it. Can they make this gift that will ultimately provide these funds? I think there's also a transformation that needs to happen on the point of those who receive the gift.
Right.
They need to discern how to use that gift well, to discern how to transform lives, to discern how they are called to be the hands and feet of Christ.
Right.
And then also on behalf of the fundraiser, to have that transformation in their own heart. Do you see your role as that of an evangelist, not just someone who is, a widget or, just a small mechanism in a big machine? Do you really see it as a work of ministry, as we've talked about before, too?
So. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, when you think, and most people don't know this, they don't have a reason to interact necessarily with someone. But for example, large foundations, there are large charitable foundations, we work with a number of them, who have maybe even hundreds of millions of dollars that they must give away each year. Mm-hmm. And it actually takes a number of professional people to facilitate the proper giving away of that money.
Absolutely.
Because you can't just start throwing it around, because the point of this fund is to make an impact. Other people, many people may have need of the money, and so they ask for it through various grant requests and so forth. But it's evaluating those grant requests and understanding who's going to be able to make the most impact and who is perhaps not ready, or who already has other sources of funding and so forth. So it's just interesting that it has always struck me as interesting that people who have substantial wealth actually have a pretty big job. The job of being a good steward of that wealth is actually kind of involved.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It's one of those sides of, you know, those who I have colleagues and friends who worked in family offices, mm-hmm. for families, and, you know, just you begin to learn the complexity of some of the gifts. You begin to learn the complexity of the transfer of wealth. There's relationships at play here. There's, you know, families, generational giving and things like that. Yeah.
Diocese here is small in terms of number of Catholics, but I've certainly come to know that the philanthropists, the donors in the diocese here, are very generous. And that's because, A, I see it in the diocesan needs that people help us with, but also I see it in the fact that there are tons of Catholic opportunities in the diocese for giving. And so the donors are being asked by multiple groups of people within the diocese, multiple entities within the diocese, schools and other apostolates, our Catholic charities, our hospitals, all of these things. And so they have multiple opportunities, so they have to be judicious.
Yes.
As well as generous.
Yeah. One of the funnier experiences out there was well, unfortunately for the, I think there was, I don't know if there was a golf tournament or there was something going on out there. And so hotels were just booked up. And so there wasn't really a convenient way to get to the hotel. So all of us had to either walk, essentially a 20-minute walk to the hotel, or we had to take Uber rides and things like that. And so me and a couple of friends, we called an Uber ride to go back to the hotel, and it was a self-driving car. Mm-hmm. And so I got to ride in a self-driving car multiple times. And I see you shaking your head, so I know you're already not a fan of this. And so we hop in, and you know, I'm just like totally willing, you know, just like I hop in an airplane and I trust them to fly it. You know, I'm hopping in this car, I'm trusting that it's going to work out. You know, I'm trusting that there's a human somewhere involved up in space somewhere who's on a, you know, somebody's figuring me out. But anyways, it was an exhilarating experience. All the self-driving cars were also Jaguars, so they're all very nice vehicles. But it was pretty funny to see all of our reactions just kind of light up as we were, you know, kind of waiting to turn, and the car is kind of hesitating and making us all nervous. And there's this nervous laughter in the car. And so it was pretty funny. But then it became a game, because once you've done it once and they've gotten you where you need to go safely, you know, then you kind of go, oh, I guess I trust this a little bit. And so you gain trust. And then it became a game. Then you're trying to call a self-driving car via Uber and then inviting people into it. And they're like, what are all the bells and whistles? Because it's got like a spinning camera on the top and these spinning sensors on the corners. And, you know, the thing looks strange, right?
Yeah.
It looks like really bizarre. And so, but one of the funnier things was, is I didn't put my seatbelt on initially. And we're just kind of like sitting there waiting for traffic to move. And all of a sudden, an actual person comes on the phone, or the car is ringing, and there's a touchscreen in the back, and we answer the call. And it's a person who's like, excuse me, someone in the car does not have their seatbelt on, and we will, you know, stop the ride essentially if they don't put their belt on. So that was also kind of a funnier experience from the week out there. And I just can't imagine seeing those things all over the country, you know.
I'm not enough of an early adopter of of technology to, as I was telling Derek earlier, if that car had pulled up and I had seen there was no one in it, I wouldn't have got in it.
Yeah.
And it's not so much a distrust in that technology as the people that are going to be around it in the street. I don't ride my bike on roads because I don't trust distracted drivers.
Yeah.
And so to me, that technology, I just can't see how it can work when you have other people who are distracted driving around with it. But as you say, it was probably in a downtown place where it didn't get up to speed.
Near a college campus. Yeah, you could imagine that, you know, we're driving 20 miles an hour. So it was the thing would kind of hesitate sometimes and you kind of go, but you mentioned, you know, adopting technology and things like that. Speaking of maybe not adopting technology is the Clear Creek Monastery, which is a monastery here in our diocese. They had their work day over the weekend, and it's my understanding that you were out there to offer the opening mass or
opening prayer.
It was just opening prayer.
Yeah. And I don't remember if they have two a year or one. I think they have at least one, and they maybe have two a year. They get several hundred people come out.
Yeah.
Like 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning on Saturday. The monks will have lined up a number of sort of job chiefs among the volunteers. And so there's a, you know, there was one crew that was going to be chainsaw clearing a hillside. There was another crew that was going to be doing plumbing work. There was a crew that was going to be...
Plumbing work, wow.
Yeah, doing other kinds of menial kinds of tasks like that on this 1,000-acre monastery. And actually, you know, the monks are often leaders in technology. You know, it's kind of interesting in their history in terms of agricultural systems and understanding agriculture and so forth. They were often leaders in that. The monks at Clear Creek are Benedictine monks. They lead a cloistered life, so they live there in the monastery. I guess these days there's about 55 or so of them out there. It's a very...
It's a good number.
Yeah, rapidly growing monastery. They have land purchased in the Diocese of Gallup, New Mexico, to begin a new foundation when they're ready. So that's also the history of monasteries. As the monastery grows, it can't just grow continuously or it becomes too big for its own purpose. And so at a certain point, when it has sufficiently grown, it sends a daughter house out. It sends a group out to found a daughter house monastery. And then when that one grows, another daughter house goes out. And so they develop that way. But yeah, people were there as they always are, raring and ready to go, tractors and chainsaws and tools. And they have, you know, barbecue for the group that comes out and make it a big fun day of it.
Absolutely. It's one of those things where, you know, it's turned into sort of this like sort of little mini Catholic cultural event. And they have a great group of volunteers who do the outreach. I mean, I've been invited by, I think, multiple people every year for a number of years. And so, you know, it's one of those things where it's become kind of a thing to do, popular thing to do amongst, you know, Catholic families and the like, or have a chainsaw or a pickup truck and can assist these monks with some of their, you know, bigger tasks.
Now, for me, it tends to always coincide with either the women's or the men's Catholic conference. So Oklahoma City puts on a Catholic conference for women, a Catholic conference for men. And this year it was the Catholic Conference for Women. So I had to leave immediately and go to Oklahoma City. This year they had 1,200 women at the conference, so it was maxed out, so much so that they're going to change their venue now. Then this coming weekend is the Catholic Conference for Men. And then in September...
Where's that located?
Same place.
Okay.
It's in Norman, Hotel in Norman. Then in September, we have the first Catholic Conference for Women in Tulsa. So now there's a group of women in Tulsa who will coordinate putting on a similar conference for women on this side of the state. So we'll end up with two Catholic Conference opportunities for women each year, about half a year apart from each other. So you can go to one or both. But if you can't make one, you can go to the other, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, it's, again, you speak of culture. This is the kind of thing where you bring in big speakers who come in and you have lots of vendors, people who are either running Catholic apostolates or who sell Catholic paraphernalia, everything from rosaries to books to, you know, Catholic-themed scarves and veils and all kinds of stuff. And this year, what I noted especially was the presence of a lot of daughters. So a lot of younger women and little girls and babies. A lot more mothers this year nursing babies were there. So it was interesting to see that.
Mm. And a couple of things. I know that Tulsa has its annual, you know, Irish Fest that they do at the River West Parks coming up, you know, because St. Patrick's Day is coming up here in about a week and a half or so. And you'll be there actually offering a mass.
Yeah. Yeah, Marcel Brown, who was the headmaster of our classical school at Holy Family till recently, had invited me to celebrate a mass. I think it's the first time that it's been done at this Irish Fest. I have never been to the Irish Fest, and so I'll learn along with anybody
else. Not shocked by that.
Anybody. Yeah. Now, I am Irish in my background. My grandmother's maiden name was Kelty. It is on March the 10th, this Irish festival, and it's at the Dublin Tent. So any of you who want to come out for a fun Irish festival, come out on March the 10th.
At 9:30,
Yeah, to the Dublin Tent. And if you'd like to go to Mass, we'll be doing that at 9:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll shake a jig or shake a leg or look for a pot of gold or whatever it is we do.
And have Mass.
And have Mass.
That's yeah, when I was looking it up, I was looking it up just to get some general information on it, and I saw that there is another sort of, you know, religious service before the Catholic Mass. So
I thought
that was interesting too.
Okay.
So I'm curious if that is a new thing or not. So we'll have to find out more information. I'm sure you'll get information from that, and maybe even on one of the next episodes you can kind of.
Well, I mean, it ought to be. I mean, related to it. I mean, the Irish, of course, are particularly known for their Catholic faith and religious faith. And we have also their saint, St. Patrick, coming up on the 18th. This year it doesn't fall on a Friday of Lent, and so we don't have to put out all kinds of letters of dispensations and whatever.
Oh, my goodness,
so people can eat corned beef on St. Paddy's Day. and St. Paddy's Day, though, is good for, especially for Catholics, to remember and to model for everyone that it is the celebration of a saint. It is a saint's feast day. And so to just go out and get drunk and like we're a bunch of banshees is not the best way to celebrate a saint's feast day, but perhaps particularly to go to Mass and to recognize that the story of St. Patrick, for one thing, speaks to us of God's providence. We just read at Mass, we had the passage from the book of Exodus of Joseph being sold into slavery by his jealous brothers.
That's right.
And having 11 siblings myself, I can see that happening. I can totally see that. Joseph, who sold into slavery to Egypt, but who in God's providence, that disaster for his personal life puts him in the position that later is the salvation for his family, his tribe, his people. And so similarly, St. Patrick sold into slavery. God uses that disaster to evangelize this whole island nation of Ireland. And so it simply reminds us that when something bad is happening in our life, something that we don't want, something that maybe we're grieving over.
Yeah.
We should not ask the question, why is God doing this to me? We should ask the question, what is God going to do with this? Because God always is bringing about what is good for us. And if something bad is happening, if the good is not happening in that moment, we want to be people who have that kind of faith that are saying, I wonder what this is going to bring. What's going to come of this? Joseph, sold into slavery in Egypt, could have asked the question, I wonder what God is going to do with this. I'm a slave in Egypt now. And then the same with St. Patrick, a young boy sold into slavery. I wonder what God is going to do with this. And voila.
I think it's those moments of, you know, from my perspective, that's a person who would ask that question is a person who has a lot of gratitude, a person who's operating from a place of peace in their life. Easier said than done.
Sure.
Those tough things come. I think I'm just thinking about my own life, and just I was praying about a week and a half ago, and just something that came to mind was just having a greater sense of gratitude and just reflecting gratefully on the blessings of my own life, and just having these moments of like, oh wait, I'm distracted again. I should get back to gratitude, because when you do that, and you think about the many blessings that you have, gosh, the overwhelming amount of peace that comes over you. So that's actually a really good reminder of that. I think
it's an antidote to that same jealousy and envy that caused Joseph to be sold into slavery. Because when we're feeling jealous or envious of someone, we're not feeling grateful.
Correct. Yep.
And so if we would, as soon as we recognize I'm feeling jealous and envious of someone, if we would take that as the cue, okay, wait a minute, let me stop and thank God for whatever in my life, that's the antidote, I think, to that. We have some other events coming up. The JCYC Junior, how's it go? Junior Catholic Youth
Conference.
Conference, that's it, Junior Catholic Youth Conference. That's coming up on March the 8th. I can't see anymore. March the 9th
at St. Benedict's.
Yeah, at St. Benedict's. So that's something for people to watch out for.
Yeah. If you're interested in more information, you can reach out to Dustin Sanford, a.k.a. Moose, I believe he's affectionately known as, at St. John's Catholic Center in Oklahoma State.
So, oh, that's right. And the Altar Server Retreat, March the 8th at Christ the King.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all events that I'll be at.
Yes.
And you know, we publish in the EOC, we publish sort of bigger public events that, that I'm at in there. And I hear from people often who say, gosh, I can't believe you do all these things, blah, blah, blah. Look, I remember my mom. She was a whole lot busier than I ever have been.
Oh, my goodness.
So my standard response will be to say that every mother of three or more children is busier than I'll ever be. But it is true that I go to a lot of events, and there is a real sense, at least in my heart, that the masses that I celebrate all around the diocese and the events that I'm able to attend are the main part of what my life is and ought to be as a bishop, to be a shepherd who is out among the people of the diocese that I serve. That to me is the main thing, the easiest thing for me in terms of doing. I just have to go there. There's a lot of other things that a bishop is called on to do, and a lot of things that happen in the office or in meetings or through emails and all that. And those, of course, are often very, very important too. But the main thing, you know, if I was going to fail at something, I'd rather fail in a way at those things than at being out among people. Because, you know, if I spent all my time in the office,
sure,
I could get a lot done. But what effect would that have on my diocese? So I don't want to do that. Naturally, there needs to be a balance, but
yeah,
I like to weight the balance towards being out there with the people.
You and I have talked about this before, but we happen to be in the same place at the same time. We were out visiting friends, and we were in a rural area, and we ended up being at the same Mass on a Sunday.
Oh, right.
But you get around town so much and get around all the parishes, and then somebody came up and asked, hey, are you guys like here because of the bishop? Did you like drive out here? Just a coincidence.
Yeah.
The other weird thing is I actually work for him. So like, you know, it's kind of one of those funny things. So I think that's great. Another thing that we did is we released our 50th episode of Tulsa Time. Mm. And so, going back to gratitude a little bit, very grateful for Adam Minahan and his launch of the Bishop's Podcast.
Did I mention Exodus 90? I didn't mention
Exodus. Did we mention Exodus yet? We need to plug Exodus every time we mention Adam. But a couple of fun facts about that. So I think the biggest thing is just that I was reading online, you know, and with, and to what level of truth is this? But I was reading that 90% of podcasts quit after 3 episodes. Okay. And so another 90% after that quit after episode 20. So we can sincerely say it feels good to be in the top 1% of all podcasts ever created. And so that's, that's something that a little math there to figure that one out. But,
and it doesn't feel like it to me. I'm surprised to hear that 50 episodes. I remember, you know, when we started just in the living room at my house. But because we do them a couple a week, usually.
And we do them in bulk. That's a fun fact about how we produce
We do
this.
Them a couple a week, and we try to think out ahead, you know, what's going on, what's coming up. I suppose because of the—and because we established at the beginning that we wanted this to be more of a free-flowing kind of a conversation, more spontaneous than studied. So we haven't generally— done episodes where we needed a lot of notes and we had to stick to kind of a script or something like that. That makes it easier to do. Hopefully it also makes it more engaging to see or to listen to. But yeah, that's amazing. 50 episodes.
It takes about some fun facts about it, or it takes about 90 minutes of total work. You know, we have a great staff, you know, Renata Copsey and Daniel McKay, who are actually always in the room
in
with
the
us.
Shadows.
They're in the shadows in the studio here with us every time. So we're able to turn these around pretty quickly because I get asked that all the time. People are like, how can you do development stuff and edit all those podcasts? I go, I'm not editing podcasts. I go, that's not how this would work. So.
Well, but it points to a lacuna in my own awareness is to remember that. It's important for me to remember that. I'm here for whatever time it is that we shoot the thing. But then you guys have to go to work after that and then dub it and cut the shorts out and the reels and whatever all the things are. And
cut out all the profanity.
Yeah. All the blue language has to be edited.
That's right. looking back at, and we've had over 20,000 downloads, which is also kind of that sounds big when you say it like that. But I don't know, has there been this is kind of a generic question, but has there been a favorite podcast or a favorite topic or a favorite guest or something that we've done? I know for me personally, you know, I've only done about 9 of these things, which gosh, when you think about 50, it's like, oh, wow, that's, you know, that's 20%. Wow. That time does go by quickly. But having Dr. Mary Rice Hassan on here recently was really interesting. I've received a couple of comments about that, but I don't know about you. What about you?
You know, topics, we've just covered so many, so I can't remember, of course, all of them, but the topics that we did a series. The closest thing that we've done to a series of podcasts was on marriage preparation and you know, dating and marriage preparation. And with all the years that I spent in campus ministry, I suppose that kind of a topic is still near and dear to my heart. Now, as the bishop of a diocese, I need to be able to think and look long term, and so that's a long term. That's a long-term kind of a topic. The thing that will have a huge impact on a diocese is how young people are raised, how they're raised early, how their parents understand themselves to be teachers of the faith to their children. They are teaching the faith to their children, and that is affecting the way the children grow up, the attitudes and perceptions they have, including things like dating and including things like how do I decide my vocation? How do I pick a spouse? And then when I marry, why? Why do I marry? What's the point of marriage? So that results in rich families, families who are rich in faith, and those families have the biggest impact on the diocese.
Absolutely. It's interesting to hear you always reflect on your time at St. Mary's because, you know, it's one of the unique, I mean, there are unique roles for pastors in every diocese, whether you work with the prisons or thinking of Father Keat or, you know, like Father Carey in Stillwater or also Father Porter here at the Newman Center, only working with college students. You know, I mean, you have some folks who are married or, you know, things like that. And you think about normal parish life of baptism to grave, your ministry is sort of plays out like that. But, you know, if you're at a campus center, you know, you're always working with young people. You're always doing marriage preparation. It seems like you're always, you know, in that unique place where you're working with people who are really making all the decisions about what they believe for the rest of their life. So that,
yeah, parishes have the whole gamut. Birth to death, 0 to 106. I recently learned of someone who was 106.
That's awesome.
But campus ministries have primarily a 6-year age window.
Yeah.
The cast of characters changes every year. Some leave and some come, but you maintain yourself in that 6-year window. And so those elements of life that impinge on those 6 years of all of our human lives are the primary things that you're constantly dealing with, just with different people all the time.
Yeah.
So it is interesting. Yeah.
The other milestone that we're celebrating that everybody will get in the mail here in the coming week or so is our 150th issue of our Eastern Oklahoma Catholic magazine. As many people know, back in around 2008, we went from a newspaper to a magazine in an effort to be more engaging and to have a colorful piece that has beautiful pictures and artwork and some other articles, you know, in a different style and format. And I think it's been a successful decision. We get lots of compliments. I know when I have friends in from out of town, from bigger archdioceses that have big papers still, and they release a paper once a week. And they always say, gosh, I really like your guys' magazine. And part of me wonders, I go, is it the content? You know, is it really the bishop's letter at the front? Or is it, you know, or is it just the fact that it's a colorful piece with beautiful pictures of events that are actually happening and things like that? Has a higher readership for sure.
I know for myself, you know, coming here from outside, when I first saw it, I immediately was drawn to it, and it is the color and the presentation of it, the magazine format, and so I'd only ever known the newspaper kind of a diocesan publication. So I like it that I have heard from some people in the diocese who say it needs to have more just local stuff going on, more local color and local stories. But I also know people who love to read it because there are some more substantive articles from Catholic, you know, theologians or, you know, people in the Catholic world who are making news or whatever. So, you know, we strive for some kind of a balance of those things.
Yes.
It also gives us the opportunity to highlight our excellent hospitals, which we have and are blessed to have. It's amazing to have such a small Catholic community in the diocese, and yet the hospital systems that we have are the whole state, you know, they're big as a state. So we strive for a balance. It's interesting, we hit 150 right as we close the 50th anniversary year of the diocese. So that's just kind of interesting.
We planned that. And we made that decision back in 2008.
Now we have them in the grocery stores and in some casinos. The thing that I have not connected till now, because I think our notes mention that we had them in the prison. And I guess maybe Father Kit puts them out in prisons, but we haven't used them at the jail, but we could. So that sparks a note in me, is that we could use them in the jail.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's great having a periodical that not only is there for events, but also evangelizes. And I think it's been great. And have to give a little bit of a shout out to Dave and Mason and Rod, who are part of the team that really brought it along with Monsignor Brinken. So really a great crew that brought it about. So
yeah.
So great. Well, thank you all for joining us this week. This has been Tulsa Time with Bishop Condorla. My name's Derek Lissy, and we hope you have a great rest of your week.